And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Before I get going, I want to say that some of our news clips are pre-recorded, in particular, if they are with someone from Europe, because of the time differences. Our guests, however, will always be live for your interaction. Speaking of guests, our guest for the show today is Ben Hurl. He is the director of the Victorian UFO Action, VUFOA, a UFO investigation organization based in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. VUFOA, I think that's how you say it, investigates UFO reports from across Victoria and applies a common sense approach to the topic, focusing on evidence education and reporting of UFO events. Check out their website at VUFOA.com. Ben will be coming up later on. Before we speak to him, I have a new astronomy segment coming up, and then I'm speaking with a debunker. So hold on for a second. We'll be right back. And make sure that you live listeners sign up on our chat room. Go there right now at podcastufo.com. On Skype in the UK, a longtime listener of the show, an amateur astronomer. I've brought him up in a couple of podcasts about a triangular UFO sighting. We're going to talk about that later. But first, Andy Fleming is going to be joining us, and he's going to tell us some astronomy news, and this week in particular, what's up in the night sky. How you doing, Andy?
Hello, Martin. I'm absolutely fine. All the better, my friend, for speaking to you after what must be about a year and a half communicating by email.
That's right.
Took me that long to get Skype working.
Yeah, we've had a couple of technical issues, but we're going fine now. So why don't you tell us what's going on?
I'm calling this little segment tonight, if you like, What's Up in the Night Sky. It's an astronomy feature. Just to let you know, what isn't an unidentified flying object or unidentified aerial phenomena. So it gives you some idea about the bright things that are already up there without any help, human or otherwise. And the planets on show during the night at the moment include the most stunning and the brightest of them all, well, virtually, the solar system's largest planet, which is Jupiter. It's south of overhead, which is what we astronomers term the zenith. It's available to view from late evening onwards, and binoculars will reveal the four Galilean moons discovered by the Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei in 1609 with one of his first telescopes. A small telescope, if you've got one, will also reveal the planet's spectacular cloud bands. It does look good. If you've got a bigger telescope, you may well be able to see the Great Red Spot, which is a massive cyclone which has been going on since at least the time of Galileo. So if you think the weather's bad here on Earth, don't take a trip to Jupiter. The radiation's pretty bad as well. Anyway, in the pre-dawn eastern sky, the amazingly bright Venus which is actually the brightest planet that we see. That rises 2 hours before the Sun. And both Venus and Jupiter, as I'm sure listeners to the programme will be well aware, are often confused with UFOs, especially when driving. That's because, from the car occupant's perspective, an illusion's created that gives the impression that these objects are actually following your vehicle. That's because they're behind foreground objects such as trees, etc., etc. Also, in the pre-dawn, Saturn is an easy object in the south-southeast in the constellation of Libra. It's the brightest object in this part of the sky. Once again, telescope reveals the planet's beautiful ring system and its largest moon, the enigmatic little world called Titan, and believe it or not, that has an atmosphere of methane. Don't strike a match. Don't worry about it. There isn't any oxygen coexisting in its atmosphere, so you wouldn't have an explosion anyway. New moon occurs during this week. Mercury is an interesting one. Climbs to its maximum altitude in the dusk sky. Now then, this elusive little world is difficult to observe on the far western horizon because, of course, it's so near the Sun and you get cloud banks and mountains and buildings and all that. It's very, very difficult to find full stop in areas with a cloudy climate like where I am, the UK, Western Europe, or, of course, Western North America. I've only seen it a couple of times myself. It's around midnight local time, wherever you are, low in the eastern sky, you'll see an ochre-coloured point of light in the constellation of Virgo, and that is Mars, the red planet, whose average distance to the Earth is a mere 225 million kilometres. It appears noticeably brighter than its neighbouring star, the blue-white star, Spica. Very, very quickly, you will if you've got a telescope, but not binoculars. You will if you've got a decent little telescope, be able to make out the icy pole caps on Mars if you have a look at it. And there you go. That's what's up this week.
Wow. Hey, thank you, Andy. Now, let's talk a little bit about your sighting, because I have heard over and over again that, boy, if there are UFOs actually out there, how come no astronomers are seeing them when they're out with their telescopes or, you know, out in their observatories or whatever? Well, what do you have to say about that?
My view on that is that, having seen one myself, it's not true. I don't know about the likes in the past of J. Allen Hynek and people like that who did a lot of good work in the field of astronomy and ufology. Whether he actually saw one himself, I don't know. I certainly did. Whether or not these are alien spacecraft or whether they are black ops spacecraft, drones, etc. So something of terrestrial origin, in other words. I don't know.
Let's hear more of the details about the night and exactly what happened.
Yeah, well, it was, from what I remember, it was a Friday night. I mean, I could trace it back. I've got it. It was April the 25th, 2009. It was about 11:30 p.m. here in Teesside, which, for listeners globally and in America, is on the eastern side of England, so northeast England. I was finishing just doing a few sketches of some of the galaxies I've been looking at. I thought, I'm a smoker, so I'll have a cigarette and stand on the doorstep, as you do. And I've heard this quite a few times, actually. Smokers and dog walkers make great UFO observers and witnesses. There are a lot of us because we're outside, you see.
It really does depend on what they're smoking, though.
Oh, this was definitely legal, and very, very expensive here in the UK as well. All of a sudden, I noticed above the apex of next door's roof, this huge, large V-shaped formation of five orangey-red lights. They were evenly spaced, sort of slightly east of Zenith, and moving extremely slowly in a northwest to southeast direction, going across the main part of Teesside because we live on the north side of the River Tees. I mean, I was quite mesmerised and Obviously, after they were going very slow. This whole thing must have lasted 10 or 15 minutes. Now, I began to realise that the lights they must have been attached to a single object because they were blocking out the background stars and they were in an unchanging distance from each other. In other words, they were on a fixed formation. Because my first thought, it's not obviously nothing astronomical. That was basically it. Very interesting, still unexplained. I remain a healthy skeptic. I'm certainly not a debunker.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thanks so much, Andy, and we'll be looking forward to talking to you next week. Now we're going to be talking to a guy named Mick West, who is actually debunking the UFO that everybody's talking about on the moon, the triangle formation, and we'll hear what he has to say. He's coming right up next. So I'm with Mick West, and you're out in L.A., right, Mick?
That's right.
Yes, and, you know, I was looking for stories this week in our news, and over and over and over again, I see this triangle on the moon. You know, I looked at it, and I thought, wow, those lights are so perfect on that triangle. You know, it's got to be something other than, you know, created by nature or, you know, I mean, I thought, wow, this really could be something. And then I came across your blog, read through, you have like a debunking blog, but not in a bad sense, because I think of, you know, the bad word of debunking in the UFO community is because a lot of debunkers just plain use proclamations and don't really back anything up. However, you did such a thorough job. Can you right off the bat just say the name of the website so someone can find this?
The website is metabunk.org. And yeah, like you say, it's really a site where I try to investigate things rather than just saying this didn't happen or this isn't true. I look into the actual claims of evidence behind something, and I try to figure out if that claim of evidence actually has any basis.
And so when you're looking down at this crater, you see what appears to be a triangle with lights on it. And this all had to do with photography. So I want you to, if you would, kind of go through the process of how you figure this out first and then explain exactly what people are seeing, if you would.
Well, the first thing I noticed was that it's arranged in a very regular grid. And if you look at the image, you see the around the triangle, there's similar lines that are all lined up. And that kind of showed me that it was basically pixels, individual dots on the image that have been enlarged. I'm very familiar with pixels because my background is in video game programming. So I'm very used to looking at things that are zoomed in like this and understanding what they are. And then the next thing I noticed was that when you zoomed out a bit, the seven dots just disappeared, which told me that they were in one layer of the Google Earth image, but not in the other. When you zoom in, it's using a different set of images. So I figured out from that it was probably some kind of image processing artifact. And then I looked into it a bit more, and I found out that the dots were actually not white dots at all. They were actually transparent dots. And what you were seeing was the surface of the moon image that was underneath this particular image. And you can see on the site, on Metabunk, I do a little experiment where I take a pink triangle and I put it underneath that image, and then you can see through. And that proves conclusively that it's not actually part of the image. It's just actually basically like little holes in the image.
Yes. And you've seen how, as you have looked into this, because you've been searching online as myself, you see how this thing's kind of gone viral.
Yes.
And all over the world, you know, people are thinking this is a UFO on the moon, or it's a base or something like that. And, you know, well, I don't know how to say this exactly. It might be fun to believe that this may be so for a lot of people. And it's exciting, you know, this is like feelings that I could have and things like that, that, you know, this could be a possibility. But wouldn't we rather know the truth? And I really like when something's looked at very carefully and not just believed in just because it's the first thing you think of when you see something.
Yeah, and I think what you talked about earlier comes into play here. If someone tries to debunk it just by brushing it off and saying, oh, that's just an image processing artifact, then people will say, oh, well, you haven't proven that, you haven't shown that, you haven't demonstrated it. And it's very easy for people then to believe that it is actually something strange, even if, like, some expert comes along and just, you know, says that it is an image processing artifact. People are predisposed to believe more interesting things than the more mundane things. And people react against debunking when debunking is done badly.
Yes. Which is,
I try to do it in a more thorough and gentle manner, so you don't get that pushback. If you explain things clearly and calmly and politely to people, then you get a much better reaction than if you try to assert something.
Yeah, one more thing I want to say, though. If you do go to this website and you scroll down, you will see, like, a GIF of a video of this thing being drawn back from the different layer of images, and you will see the lights fade away to nothing. So do check out that website again. And one more thing. Have you ever looked into the face on Mars and try to figure out what the heck that is?
Well, the face on Mars, I think, has been shown by the higher resolution images just to be a mountain. I mean, it's a similar type of thing to this. This particular, the triangle on the moon, there actually are higher resolution images of that particular crater, and you can look at that crater in much more detail than is available on Google Earth, and you can see there's nothing there. And it's the same thing with the face on Mars. There are high-resolution images available of that area now, and you can look at it from all different angles, and you can see it's really just a hill that just has a bit of an unusual shape, and when the sun hits it one way, it looks a bit like a face.
Well, I know one thing. I'm going to keep an eye on your website for when something kind of spectacular comes up, because I want to check to see if you have looked into certain things. And I'd like to have you back on, because I think you're doing a great job and how you're approaching this.
Thank you very much. I'd love to be back on.
All right, that's it for this segment. Hang in there. We'll be right back with Ben Hurl right after this music break. Stay with us. Ben Hurl, how you doing?
Hi, Martin. How are you?
Very good, and glad to meet you. You're down in Australia, and we're again traveling into the future. You're on Thursday. You're Thursday there, aren't you?
That's correct. Thursday afternoon at about 20 past 12 in the afternoon.
Yes. Hey, thanks for... I'm glad our time zones actually lined up like this. It's kind of a bummer because I can't talk to a lot of people in Europe, but still so glad that you decided to come on the show. And you are basically kind of be following up on some of the things that we spoke about with around, I think it came out Christmas Day with Shane Ryan, Westall incident. And he mentioned the bent light headlights and all that stuff. We're going to be talking about all kinds of things. But first of all, I wanted to ask you how you got involved in the UFO scene to begin with.
Yeah, no worries at all, Martin. For me personally, it's always been a lifelong interest. The first book I ever bought at school, at primary school, was a book on UFOs. And throughout my life, I had always had a deep fascination with the possibilities of what this universe must actually hold. The fact that there's no way known that we can be alone. And it's been something that's been at the forefront of my mind for quite a long time. Over the years too, I'd had a couple of sightings of my own down here, and I'd seen things that I just couldn't explain, that didn't meet the rationalisation that I wanted to apply to it. And that made my interest grow even further. I became even more fascinated by the topic. But being busy with life and everything else, I sort of had to treat it as a bit of a hobby and more of a casual interest for quite a few years. And then about two to three years ago, I thought, no, now's the time to actively get involved. I really do want to get into this topic, and I want to get involved in investigation, and I want to see what's happened in my own state and in the past and what is happening currently. So I made the decision to go down to Melbourne and attend a UFO meeting. Now, I don't live in Melbourne. I live up in the pointy end of Victoria, and it's about a three-hour drive. So as you can see, I was pretty keen. I wanted to go to that trouble to go down there, and I attended George Simpson's UFORN meeting. And that was the first one I ever went to, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, what am I going to be in for here going to a UFO meeting? What sort of people am I going to meet when I attend this type of place? Will I be wearing tinfoil hats? And all those crazy things went through my head. And I got down there, and the thing that I really noticed was that everybody was rational, everybody was normal, everybody had some type of experience that they could not explain. And like a lot of people around the world, they were just simply there looking for answers, looking for fellowship, looking to discuss the topic among people who were, you know, in a safe environment. So I immediately felt comfortable once I had arrived, you know, into this situation. And at that meeting, it just so happened that Andrew Arnold was there. And Andrew, about a year before, had created an organisation called VUFOA. That's how we pronounce it, Victorian UFO Action. And he had attended the meeting as well to promote his fledgling group. And I met him, and we both hit it off very, 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 very well. And basically, he founded it in around 2010. And at that stage in Victoria, the big doyen of UFO research had been the Victorian UFO Research Society, known as VUFORCE. And they had been active for over 40 years. And they'd started to peter out around the mid-2000s. So there was starting to become a bit of a gap in UFO research in Victoria. So with the demise of VUFORCE, he decided that, you know, now would be a great time to create a new organisation. And he was at that meeting to listen to George and to meet other people and basically to promote the group. So at that point, Andrew and I hooked up and we became fast friends. I do also draw some cartoons, so I did some cartoons for his website, and I became the Eastern Investigator for the eastern half of the state. So, and I really liked the way he was going about it. Like the group was sort of designed, A, to be investigative, to be hands-on, to go out and take it to the streets, get out there and, you know, into the heartland and see what's actually going on. We wanted to get into education, hold public meetings, conduct UFO tours and hold sky nights. We had some really great ideas, and many of these ideas are still evolving at this point in time. Also, importantly, we wanted to do reporting as well for our local area, you know, on UFO events, both, you know, present and from the past. So we really wanted to bring the history of Victorian UFO history to meet the present and combine all of that up into an organisation that was really ticking all the boxes again, leading on from what VUFORCE had done. So we created a hotline service. One of the first things we did for reporting UFO events, so that people actually had somewhere to call again in Victoria to report their sightings. And at the same time, also, we realise too that there's sort of, you know, almost double aspects to the phenomenon. There's the lights in the sky classic cases, and then there's the people who have the more complex experiences of alien abduction. So we found a counsellor who had had experience in hypnotherapy and was actually an abductee herself, and she came on board with us to handle that side of it. And we didn't feel overly qualified to work in that area because it is a fairly specific field with a lot of care and attention has to be exercised. But we wanted the organisation to have that full rounded experience so that everybody could, no matter what their level of experience, they could come to us and have their needs met. So, but the whole key of it was, you know, really, let's focus on Victorian events. You know, we could have done Australia, but the problem is Australia is like the United States. It's a very, very large place. Mm. And what happens is, you know, you start to spread yourself way too thinly, and the organisations invariably tend to founder when you go onto a national level for an Australian population of about 21 million people. We're nowhere near the population of the United States. Land size, yes, we're just as big, but geographically, you know, a couple of American cities have got the whole population of Australia. So it's a very sparse environment, which I think does make it ideal for UFOs to come down and visit here. So
I always wonder that because I look at, you know, every month I look through where the majority of people are listening from. And I mentioned this before when I was speaking with Shane. Australia is usually number four on the list, which is pretty amazing. And it's kind of the same thing with Sweden. It's a smaller population, and they're always, you know, right there, number five or six, something like that. So I'm picturing Australia as mostly people along the coast and also near the big cities, and then the rest of it's just sparse. Is that basically it?
That is very much a true assessment, Martin. Yes, it's very much an urban-based living system in Australia. You've got your major cities of Melbourne and Brisbane and Sydney on the eastern seaboard, and out from that there's some larger regional towns and regional areas, but there's these vast stretches, miles and miles of empty land, empty desert, empty wilderness. The country is fairly empty for its size, but at the same time too, the geography of the country certainly also dictates that because we don't have any internal rivers that run through, like the Mississippi that runs through America, which is you know, a great asset to that country and enables a lot of people to live in the inland. Australia is a lot older, and there's no rivers in that internal area, so it's just becomes one giant desert out in the middle part, which forces all the population to live on the coast. Now, it's very beautiful here, and the coast is absolutely fantastic, but that's the general picture of how our country is more or less, you know, populated.
And so, the sightings, are they generally speaking toward the interior or are all along the coastline as well?
Look, here in Victoria, every region of the state has got its UFO history. There's not an area of the state that you can say, well, we're not getting sighting reports from here, or there's been no reports over there. The Western districts, the North Desert country, the Northeast, the East Gippsland, where I live, and certainly around the Melbourne area, has had a continued and very, very varied and rich history of UFO experiences. And I think that when we talk about UFO cases in Victoria and certainly internationally, it's the Victorian cases are the ones that are really well known. And I'm not saying that to be parochial in any way at all or to indicate that Queensland, New South Wales or anywhere else don't have their UFO events, but the Fred Valentich case, the Westall case, the Kelly Cahill case, they're all really big-name cases that have achieved worldwide recognition over the years, and they've all basically originated here in Victoria.
Right. I just want to take just a second here and explain something because we have a chat room going. And by the way, if you're listening live right now on the Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com, go right on our chat room. We also have a phone line available. I'm a little hesitant to give that out only because I get a lot of complaints because the only way we can take a phone call is to interrupt the guest. But anyway, if you'd like to call in, I will try to gently interrupt you, and that number is 603-967-4030. And also, I just wanted to say that this week's guest was supposed to be Chuck Fultz of the Allagash incident. And I really do thank you for filling in at such short notice tonight, Ben. Chuck, I called to confirm him on Monday. In between about 50 coughs, I think I heard the word sick. Anyway, he couldn't even talk when he answered the phone. So I just sent him an email that I'm going to reschedule him probably around the 25th or so of February. But anyway, I do appreciate you coming in. And we do have the chat room again, podcastufo.com. And so let's go into right away. Do you have anything to add? I know you listened to Shane Ryan's podcast. Do you have anything to add to the Westall incident after listening to that?
Look, Shane is pretty much the expert on Westall, and I think that anyone who really wants to learn about that particular incident really will learn all there is to learn through either watching the Westall 66 Suburban Mystery documentary or to listen to the interview that he did for you. We made the decision that, you know, we didn't need to go near Westall because it had a lot of focus and a lot of attention and certainly a lot of publicity. But we made the decision that there were several other UFO events around that time that they touched on in Westall and they alluded to it, but they didn't have the time and the resources or the focus to look at those incidences. So we thought that we would go back and do a cold case investigation on the two previous events that had occurred.
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yeah. One more thing. I'm watching the chat room, and another thing that I wanted to bring up. I'm sorry. I'm losing my place here. Let's get right into the topic that Ryan did bring up very shortly, and it's called the bent headlights.
Yep.
Incident. Now, I may have just said that totally wrong, but there was a situation where the headlights kind of went off the road, and then the guy crashed. And wasn't there two incidences that happened like one day right after the other, or something like that?
It was about 3 days between the events, but you're correct, and we really thought it was really time to go back and have a look at that entire situation, because there's been a lot of sort of almost assumption, you could say, about the two events being linked, and we thought it really does need to be looked at what happened to Ron and what happened to Gary. So about 6 months ago, we made that decision to do that. But before I start on that, I'll just give you a bit more of a recap on the dates to give your listeners a refresh on what actually occurred back in 1966. So, the whole incident really began on the 2nd of April 1966, when a witness took a photograph of an unusual object in the leafy Melbourne suburb of Baldwin. And this particular photo at the time ended up in the Herald Sun, which is the leading newspaper in Melbourne. And it sort of was almost the precursor to what was going to be a very intense period of UFO activity in Victoria. And in fact, I wish I had been alive at the time, because it would have been really good to have been there as an investigator at that point in time. So that incident occurred on the 2nd of April. Then on the 4th of April, which was a Monday, that's when Ron Sullivan had his bending lights experience at an area known as Burke's Flat. Now, Burke's Flat is a very much a flat land farming community area, big sky country, you could call it, and it's relatively remote and sort of, you know, away from larger town areas. So his incident occurred on the 4th of April. Then 2 days later, on the 6th of April 1966, the Westall school incident occurred, and that has been one of the biggest events that has possibly occurred in the world, let alone Australia, in terms of a daylight sighting with mass witnesses. So that was a really big time when we've had three major events occur. Then on the 7th of April 1966, Gary Taylor was actually killed when his car left the road at Burke's Flat And the amazing thing about it, and this is where the whole mystery has come, is that he actually hit the same tree that Ron narrowly avoided with his canter steer maneuver. It wasn't like he crashed 50 metres up the road or 100 metres or 200 metres down the road. It was at the exact same spot. And that really, really made it a very, very intriguing mystery, the fact that a young man was killed. And Ron at the time, after his incident, had certainly decided that he wasn't going to tell anybody about it. And once he had heard that there was someone had died, he felt it was his civic duty to come forth and mention that he had a strange experience at that particular time. So that gives everybody just a bit of a refresh on, you know, what actually was occurring in Victoria. And certainly at that time in 1966, it was, I suppose you could certainly call it a little bit sleepier, I suppose, and none of these events would have probably really been in the forefront that they are now with all our modern technology and the way that the internet works. You know, all this stuff is really pretty much pretty available. So it was certainly a time when to get such a big flap occurring at a time in history when if it occurred now, it certainly would be set up a lot better to really investigate it properly. And effectively at the time too, back in 1966, it was the thorough investigations just didn't occur at those times, both, you know, with Westall and the Bourke's Flat case. So there really was, you know, a lot of opportunity there to go back and look at these cases and you know, try to answer some of these questions. So, yeah, so that just gives you a bit of background there.
Now, when he came forward and said that he had this UFO incident, did he get, you know, how was he treated at that time, you know, when he was saying this happened exactly at the same place where this this other person perished?
Well, the thing you have to understand about Ron Sullivan is that he's a pillar of the community, and he's a very credible person. I'll give you a little bit of an introduction as to who he was. At the time, he was 38 years old, and he was a steel construction businessman, married with a family, and he employed about 25 people, and he was engaged in building yards, farm sheds, and shearing sheds across the Wimmera area of Victoria. And he was a very level-headed individual, not prone to flights of fancy. And he was a pillar of his community, as I suggested. He was involved in scouts and other community groups and activities. And when you meet him, you can see that he's actually a true gentleman. And he's now currently 86 years old, so he's certainly getting a bit older. And he certainly wasn't a consumer of alcohol at that time because his life was very, very busy. And, you know, they were very busy building buildings all across the Wimmera part of the state. And he was also very familiar with that road too because he was travelling in that area to different jobs across the place. And we're talking about really large farms too. Like these farms can be up to 7,000 acres. So you're not talking about little farmlets. You're talking about very, very large properties. So he travelled the road very regularly, up to 2 to 3 times a week. And his familiarity with the Wimmera Highway and all of that area was very, 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 very good.
Wow.
So if you like, I could give you a bit of a rundown on what actually happened.
Sure, yeah, I'd like to hear that.
Yeah. Okay, so on that particular day, Ron was travelling from Maryborough, where he lived, to another small town called Witchyproof, and that was about a journey of 91 miles or 146 kilometres. And Maryborough to Bourke's Flat, where the incident actually occurred, is a distance of about 53 kilometres, which I think is about 33 miles. So basically, you know, it was a fairly decent trip that he had to take. And he was leaving on that particular evening to go up and stay the night, and the next day he was going to oversee one of the jobs that they were actually doing up there. So he was going to stay at a local hotel and return the following evening on the 5th. So, and that was fine. It was a very clear evening in autumn, was the time over here for us, is what April is. And he was driving along without incident. And when he reached an area known as Bourke's Flat, he had what I think is one of the most strange and unique encounters that I've read about in UFO history. And that's why, for me, I'm very passionate about the case. So he was driving a Ford Falcon Futura 1965 model. So for the time, he had a fairly new car. So his car was well in good condition mechanically, and there was nothing to indicate that the car would have had anything wrong with it. Now, the car was light blue in colour, and his lights were on full beam at the time that he was travelling. And he was driving at roughly around about 60 miles per hour. Of course, we drive a lot faster these days with better roads, but at that time he was making his way up there fairly casually to get there in good time. So the Bourke's Flat area, as I said before, is very flat, and the stretch of road that the incident actually occurred on is very straight. And it's straight for about a kilometre or so, and then it starts to bend. But where the incident occurred, it happened on a very straight stretch of road. So he was driving along, and when he noticed on his right-hand side a white light out in the field about 50 to 70 yards away, and Ron at that time took it to be a tractor engaged in night ploughing. And as he approached it, Ron noticed that his headlights started to flicker, and he felt a tingling and a tugging sensation inside his stomach. Suddenly, his headlights bent from the middle of the beam in a V-shape towards the object in the field, which had, at this stage, divided into two white disc-shaped objects. The lower disc was smaller, 5 to 10 feet wide, and the top disc was up to about 20 feet wide, and it rose up to a height of about 25 to 30 feet. And between the two white discs were tubes, and I say that in inverted commas, about 2 to 3 inches thick, and they displayed a matte or gaseous colours of the spectrum was passing up and down between the two discs. And the object at its maximum extension looked like an ice cream cone shape, so smaller at the bottom and wider at the top. Now, as he passed, he noticed the two discs started to converge back on each other, the lower disc climbing above the top, and the whole complex joined and disappeared into an instant into the sky. So there's kind of many things happening all at once as I'm recounting this to you, and the whole encounter was realistically only took place over about a time of a minute. So it was a very intense experience in a very, very short time frame. So when his headlights bent, the fence opposite him was lit up, and Ron had to put in a quick counter steer to avoid running off the road. Now, the canter steer avoided him running off the road, but put him on a path that hit a tree on the opposite side of the road. Now, Ron swerved, braked, and narrowly missed the tree and slowed right down to about 5 miles an hour, looking in his rearview mirror as the object disappeared. So, with that, the fact that the event was sudden, there was no warning, and his response was immediate, and his action probably saved him from crashing into that tree. So that was a very, very intense experience. And what I find really fascinating about his particular case is that the object, it certainly wasn't a silver metallic disc that we've all seen reported many times. It was an object that certainly had a lot of unique characteristics to it. And Ron noted that the light was a phosphorus type of light, and milky, and it cast absolutely no shadows at all on the surrounding trees, fields or roads. It was a very self-contained light.
You know, I have heard of this. I had the pleasure of meeting Charles Halt from the Bentwaters incident this last June. And we sat and talked, and I asked him about the beam of light, because he was saying exactly the same thing. He said it was a self-contained beam of light that didn't jump out anywhere. It just went down to the ground and left, there was no, the typical light, reflections or anything like that. It was just a very focused beam, which is really interesting.
It is, and this object was very much the same, and I think that, when he first saw it, he thought it was obviously a tractor light, but the fact that it was so self-contained, bright with a kind of a matte sort of a feel to it, and the coloured, rainbow type of lights passing up between the two discs really did indicate that it was such an unusual object, and it really was fascinating. And he was actually, as you could well imagine, he was scared, and he didn't stop. He kept going, and he since said to me that, in some ways he wished he had have stopped at the time, but I think if any of us put ourselves into that situation, the decision to stop would be perhaps an incredibly brave one.
Right.
So, yeah. So he also said to me that his headlights were immediately pulled off the road when he was parallel to the object. So so that would indicate that the object was potentially having some type of an effect on the lighted air, on the headlights itself. And it was been lots of, you know, discussion about, you know, why would only the lights be affected? Ron experienced a tingling sensation in his stomach and felt like his insides were being drawn out. But it was a fairly localized effect. It wasn't like we had trees uprooted and, you know, fences pulled down, and if it was a really strong gravitational type of effect. It seemed to be quite a subtle effect, but certainly experienced in that area. And Ron estimated that his headlights bent for approximately 10 seconds or so. So that whole thing was very, very punched out very quickly. And he was probably, perhaps in some ways, and in light of Gary Taylor's experience, very lucky to have survived.
Right. You know, so, I'd like to go a little off topic of, you know, kind of what we had planned to talk about, because, and I'm hoping you have heard about this case. It just came to mind. I think it was in the 80s, maybe in the 90s, there was a situation where all these people on a highway pulled over and they saw this UFO land, and they actually saw beings come out of it, and there were so many people affected by it. Do you know about that case at all?
You're saying in Australia?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, that was the Kelly Cahill case.
Do you know anything about that case? We can just tell that to the listeners?
Yes, I do.
All right.
The Kelly Cahill case is a very, very, very interesting situation. And what really defined it, I think, was the fact that there was independent witnesses at the time, people who weren't related or connected to one another. And often that really does add strength and solidity to the validity of a case, when the more witnesses you've got, the stronger it is. Something must have happened. So on that particular evening, that was in August 1993, Kelly had been driving from Yallourn, which is in the Latrobe Valley area, which is about 150 kilometres out of Melbourne. She'd been driving up to the leafy Dandenong area to visit a friend. And they'd gone up there to visit a friend, and she had seen a strange light in the sky on the journey up there. And she told her husband that she'd seen it, and it kind of looked like a bit like a blimp in the sky, big, bright orange lights, a row of about six or seven of these lights hovering over a field. And her husband was a bit of a non-believer, and he just said, you know, no, don't worry about it, it's probably a blimp, and they kept on going. So they went and had their lovely evening with her friend, and around about midnight or so, a bit later, they decided to come back, make the journey home again, so well and truly into the wee hours. And as they were driving back down through, and this area they are in is a fairly windy roaded area with, you know, there's trees, and it's certainly not an open type of area. And they came back out of the Dandenong Hills, back down onto the flat area, and they passed through a roundabout, and then they passed through a flash of light. It seemed like a wall of white light, and it was very bright, and they were very dazzled by it. And they passed through that, and they continued along the road, and they came to an open field area on the right-hand side. And I've been to this location. And out in the field, both of them saw this huge object hovering about 200 to 300 metres back in the paddock. And it was orange lights, big, large orange lights. And they stopped the car, and Kelly felt very, very almost elated about seeing such an object, and a bit vindicated that from her previous experience. So they both got out of the car, and they walked over to the fence line, and they looked up at the object, and it was just sitting there silently hovering, no movement at all. And they could notice, when they looked at the orange lights, they could see little silhouettes in the light area, like of little beings standing there. And all at once, a blue light came out from the bottom of the object, and it spread across the land underneath where it was. And suddenly, all these little beings started to appear at the bottom of the object. And there was about 7 or 8 or maybe 10 of them there. And they could see the beings gathered underneath the object. Now, they stood staring at this amazing sight. And all of a sudden, all the beings' eyes suddenly lit up bright red all at once. In a complete split second, they all did it at once. And then they came charging across the field. Now, it wasn't running in the way that we would think of running. They glided across the field. And it was kind of like they were operating automatically. It wasn't like a bunch of soldiers gathering around and deciding on the strategy of how we're going to go about this. These guys just operated with complete in complete unison at the same time, like there was absolutely no thinking to be involved. They knew what they were doing. They sprinted across the field, glided across the field, and I've obviously seen reports from around the world of, you know, beings gliding and not walking in the way that we would do it. And they came across the field to the fence line, and basically at that point there they were upon the couple. Now, there was also another car that stopped behind Kelly and her husband at that time, and those people had also gotten out and walked over to the fence to watch it. So the beings converged and separated, and half of them went to where Kelly was and the other half went down to where the other witnesses were. So, and at that point there, it starts to get, you know, very, very almost esoterical as to what happened, because the next memory they had was being back in their car and driving slowly down the road in a dazed type of a state, really disorientated and feeling very, very ill. They knew something had happened to them, but they didn't really talk about it. They just made their way home at that point, and the people in the other car did the same thing. And I've since also heard of a third car being further back. So that's the bare bones of the actual what happened, and it's quite interesting, because when the investigators did start researching it, they placed some carefully worded ads in the local paper in that area, and they were able to track down these other people. So we had a situation where you've had a very, very high strangeness case occur, and you've had multiple and independent witnesses converge together at the same spot, and those witnesses told very similar stories. And there's a book that Kelly wrote called Encounters, and in that book, which came out in about 1994, pretty close after the event occurred, there's pictures of the beings that both Kelly and the independent witnesses drew, and the similarities between the pictures of the beings and the pictures of the actual object themselves, the parallels were very, very similar.
Now, I believe I saw an interview with Kelly. And is Kelly's a woman?
Yes.
Yes. And if that's the one I'm thinking of, it was extremely convincing. I mean, she was really shaken up about this whole event.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, she had immediate effects from it. You know, she had, scars on her body. She went to hospital with illness concerned with her lady parts, and really suffered very much in the post time of that experience. And I think, you know, it was such a event had such a marked effect on her that people in those situations, you know, certainly start to suffer, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes. We have some questions pouring in on the chat room, and one of them is, what about the government site in the center of Australia? Is that a UFO hotspot? And has there been an investigation? And then another, I'll add another question to that. And what about tunnels there?
Oh, I think Pine Gap is certainly a bit like Area 51. It's out there in the middle of the desert, sort of a little bit further away from Alice Springs in the centre of our country. It is the premium listening post around the world for listening in on conversations. I think that's certainly its most public prime thing that it's known for. It's very remote, and I've heard reports that come from around that area. Most of them are a little bit sort of urban legendy, I suppose. You know, I don't have a lot of names, dates and times and specific things, but there's stories of the local Aborigines seeing strange objects in that place. There's hunters and people who have been out there camping and touring, seeing strange objects leaving and coming back to the base. It certainly hasn't had the really good thing about Pine Gap is that it hasn't had the focus that Area 51 has. I mean, it's under the world spotlight all the time, and it surprises me they can keep anything a secret in that installation. Whereas Pine Gap is much more remote, much more less well known, and I think for the most part, due to its location, that, you know, a lot of people just do not get out to that part of the world. I certainly have heard of tunnels extending from Darwin down to that area. Could I substantiate that? No, I could not. It's not something that we know about. But it's kind of like Dulcie too. You know, you hear these stories about these things. So what I would really like to do at some point in time, with our organisation would be to go out there and check it out, because that's what we do. We're investigators. We like to dig things, you know. And I would like to go out there for myself and have a look around that area, and see what it yields.
So you have a Dulce and you also have an Area 51. I'm loving it.
Yeah, kind of in the same place too. So it's really convenient like that, Martin.
right. Now, so, you have changed the subject a little bit. You are involved in some documentary films.
Yes, that's correct. We basically have been filming a documentary on the Ron Sullivan case, and we've filmed it. It's taken us 6 months to do this investigation, and we've really done several things. After seeing the Westall 66 documentary, and Ron actually does appear in that, I thought it'd be really good to follow up with him, and so I made contact with him, and we arranged to visit him at his home, and we conducted an extensive interview with him, over 2 hours worth of footage. And Ron, He opened up like a bird. He had this experience 47 years ago. It's as clear as a bell in his mind. And he for us came forth with all the beautiful details about what happened. And we really were able to expand on what people had previously heard about his particular experience. And he's really haunted by it. He's still trying to find answers to this day. Now, we did that with him, and that was fantastic. But then we thought we'd better contact Bill Chalker, who's one of Australia's preeminent UFO researchers, because in 1980, Bill did a retrospective investigation at that particular point in time. So we contacted Bill, and Bill was kind enough to give us some pointers as to where the incident occurred via Google Maps. And I then began the process of trying to rediscover the location 33 years after Bill, who's the only investigator who had been up there in those preceding years. And it was certainly no easy task to rediscover the exact location where Ron had the experience. Now, the crash tree was still there in 1980 when Bill was there, but has since been removed. So I looked at Bill's pictures at the location, and one picture had him standing next to the crash tree pointing at it. And I noticed in the background in the field behind him a very distinctive gum tree. And I then began the process on Google Maps of driving, in inverted commas, up and down that road looking for that particular tree. Now, my reasoning was that if the crash tree had gone, there was an excellent chance that the tree in the field would still be there. And sure enough, it was. So I found it, verified it, and then turned to face the opposite side of the road and compared the newspaper pictures from 1966 and Bill's photos. And I was able to find the exact location once again, and much jubilation ensued after we had been able to talk to Ron. And we'd also been able to verify the exact location. We knew we had it, and we knew that the next step for us to do was to actually return to the site. Now, before I talk about that, we thought it was very important to have a look at Gary Taylor and, with the accident. And there's been a lot of assumptions, but not many facts were available about what happened to him. So I approached the coroner's court and I asked them if there was any details available regarding the crash and its investigation. Yes, Mr. Hurl, you can access the record. It's at the Victorian Public Records Office, and quote this reference number. Well, it was as easy as that. I was actually really quite happy that the coroner's court was so forthcoming. And due to the period of time, it was no problem to access the record. Now, as I live in country Victoria, I was not in a position to go myself. So Ivan Rigoni, who's our chief investigator, went to the records office and collected the coroner's report, the police accident report, and photos of the crash scene and also a picture of Gary's body. So as a group, we began to read and absorb the information and were able to learn what Gary's movements were on that day. And from that also, from getting that access to those official records, we were also able to find the family that assisted at the crash scene, and we found the property owner who still to this day owns the field. And that family's had that farm since 1835. So things don't change very much up in Burke's Flat. So with all this information, we shared it with Ron, and he was really happy to get all the coroner's reports about Gary, because he'd been so puzzled about what had actually happened. And we talked to Ron, and we decided that, yes, we would all go back to Burke's Flat 47 years after the incident and film with Ron returning at the location. So I contacted the landowners, and they gave us permission to enter the field and the farming family that assisted at the crash, and we arranged to interview both of them while we were at Burke's Flat. So we had this beautiful situation where we had Ron, the original witness, the landowners, and the family that assisted at the crash all converging on the one location to really revisit this particular event. And we also took the time to lay a plaque at the location, marking the event and honouring Gary Taylor, who passed away there. We thought it was very important that we've got this area where two men had two very converging and different experiences. One had an amazing experience and the other lost his life, and he was only 19 years of age. So we thought that it was very important to lay a plaque for people who are interested to, A, find the location, and we got permission from the landowners, and they were happy for us to do it, and we put this beautiful plaque up on the tree. It's a gold plaque with black writing, and it commemorates both men. And our documentary is going to be called Burke's Flat, A Tale of Two Men. It really is looking at both men and what happened. So that was our entire focus of what we were trying to do. And we've got enough information now that it's going to be produced in three parts. It's just too big to make it into one single episode. An hour is not going to be enough time.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So and it's probably going to come out in February by the time we chase up a few loose ends. And it will be on our website for viewing. And I'm also keen to spread it in the US as well. So if anyone can assist us with this, you can always contact me. And I'd like to get it seen in America too. And my email address is benh@vufoa.com. So you might say to me, okay, that's really great. What sort of stuff have you discovered as a result of your investigation? And I can reveal some of the things that we've found out since we started this 6 months ago that have been previously unknown in any of the written records about the Bending Headlights case. So what we found out from extensive discussion with Ron, and this is a very interesting point, that there were actually dead birds on the location when he returned on the Good Friday with Hugh Hunter, who was a reporter from the Maryborough Advertiser, and Ron's 11-year-old daughter. They noticed that around the fence line there were four or five dead parrots laying on the ground, which is a relatively unusual occurrence to see that number of birds without any signs of marking or predators or anything like that, just keeled over dead. And it was April was the time of the year, so it wasn't boiling hot summer where birds would cark it over on 111 degree days like we've had here recently. So,
are there a lot of parrots in that area?
Yes, there are. Across Victoria we've got a lot of cockatoos, galahs, and you know, Australia is very well known for parrots. And I think if anyone in there has an interest in birds, they would know that you know, a lot of our birds are quite valuable. So. This has never been known before, that there was a significant number of dead birds at that particular location. Now, the physical effects on Ron hadn't been reported previously either. The fact that he had experienced a tingling sensation, pulling on his insides, that hasn't been released previously. The other beautiful thing that we've also done in our efforts is we've tracked down original pictures of the impression that was left at the time, never seen before.
Really?
Publicly, the landowner had a couple of slides that they had actually taken at the time. Now, the only other pictures of the actual, and I really should talk about what was left behind, the only other pictures had been in the Herald Sun. So that's just like newspaper quality, black and white, 1960s pictures, very grainy, not very good. So we've been able to get two slides of the image, and slide photography for the most part is very detailed. And we've been able to clean it and bring up the details much clearer than have ever been seen before with the impression that was left behind. Now, The other thing we also discovered is that nothing grew in the field in that area for 3 years afterwards.
You hear about that all the time.
Exactly. They were planting lucerne in the field is what they were actually doing back in that period of time. And in that particular spot, that 4 to 5 feet area, nothing grew, and there's a circular bare spot in that ground for quite a few years afterwards. So that was really an interesting fact to discover also from the people who owned the property. Now, we did interviews with the landowners and the farm family that assisted the crash, and these people have never been spoken to before by anyone. So no one's heard the Gary Taylor story from the farming family. No one's had an interview with the landowners. So that was really, really important things that we've been able to do. And I think perhaps most importantly of all, we were able to take a very haunted man back to the location 47 years after he had been there. And I stood next to him on that location when he returned there, and I had goosebumps.
Oh,
as we both stood there in that field looking around, and it was a warm day. It was quite warm at that time when we were there in November. So November is spring here. Right. It was actually quite unseasonally warm, and we stood there together, and the look on Ron's face going back to that spot was the best thing we could do for him. And he was just so glad to be able to go back. And we even returned there that night to go back under the same circumstances that he'd been there. And we filmed some small snippets at night. Now, we're only a fairly amateurs, we're not professionals. We had our cameras, we didn't have lighting or anything like that, so we did the best with what we had to go back there. But it was a full moon night, and I'm standing in that paddock on the exact same spot under a full moon, and was the best experience I can just about say that I've had. It was really, really gave me a great perspective of the night, the location, and it really brought it to life.
Wow, wow. So he was 38 then and 86 or something?
86 now, yeah. Wow. So he's getting on a fair bit now, and that's why I thought, look, he probably necessarily doesn't have much more time left in the world. So Somebody really needed to really grab this case to bring it to life, because it's an amazing story, and he's such a credible witness, and there was physical trace evidence left behind. There was effects on the headlights. It was really a really highly credible case, and in the context of Westall, it brings that whole era of the ufology at that time, of what was happening. It really, really intensifies the all those events that occurred.
Again, how many days apart were the two incidents?
Well, just a reminder. Ron's occurred on the 4th of April at about 10 to 8 at night PM. And Westall was on the 6th at around about 10:15 when they first noticed the object coming across the sky. So there was only 2 days between that. And then, interestingly, prior to Ron's experience, on the 2nd was when the Baldwin photo was taken. So there was kind of a two-day gap between each of these three significant events. Now, I could talk about the Baldwin case, too, also in greater detail.
Yes, if you would. You know, I tried to look that up today after I got an email from you. I really couldn't find any information on that.
Well, I've got the original case file that was done at the time when the incident actually occurred. So I was able to really glean a lot more than, and you're right, there really isn't a great deal about that particular case at that particular time. So it was, quite an amazing little event. So what happened was, the witness who actually had the experience was a very, very credible guy. He had fairly highly responsible positions, and I can't talk about what he did because he's really very private, and his identity has never really come to light. But he was a very, very highly respected individual, and he was at home at his father's place, and also at the house at the time. His father wasn't there, but there was a carpenter, and the carpenter was working on doing some modifications inside the house. And the witness said to the carpenter, "Oh, I'm just going outside, I'm taking my camera, and I'm just going to use up a roll of Polaroid film that I've got." "Yep, no problems." So he heads out into the garden, and he's just taking photos of the buildings, photos of the garden, and all of a sudden, the entire garden is lit up by this bright light, and he just was amazed by this brightness that just suddenly flashed into the garden. And he looked up, and about 150 feet up in the air, he saw a bright silver object, almost a classic UFO, for want of a better word, the metallic type of disc. And it basically appeared above the about 350 feet away, 150 feet up, and he watched as it... So it was facing with the flat side to the ground, the classic sort of position for a UFO. But then, interestingly, it inverted to 180 degrees so that it was actually on its side in the air. And he was able to snap a photograph of the object tilted on its side. Now, the object then passed through another rotation, and it's kind of rotated on its axis, and then it took off to the north and disappeared very quickly. Now, the witness was amazed by what he had seen, and he went back inside, and he said to the guy, "I've just seen this amazing thing. I don't know what I've taken a photo of." And they both heard a very loud boom, and they both thought, "What was that?" And it was like a plane breaking the sound barrier. So they went outside again, and the object had gone. So, you know, and that day was a very, very clear day. A nor'westerly wind of about 25 knots was blowing, and the object basically disappeared into the wind at a rapid rate of knots. Now, he took the photograph that he had taken, and he was able to get it blown up, and he gave it to the Victorian UFO Research Society, and they had the photo, and it ended up also appearing in the Herald at the time. And as I indicated at the start, that was really the start of a very busy time for UFO activity in the state. So again, the experience that he had happened fairly quickly, very similar to Ron's, and in some ways the Westall case stands out a little bit further because, you know, that was for a lot longer period of time. But these two events occurred in fairly quick succession, and the photo that he took is it's certainly not to the quality of today's pictures, but you can see that the report and the photo certainly stacks up in terms of what he wrote down in that report, what he saw. It's a very unusual looking object. Again, the credibility of the witness is certainly high, and it really was also in its own right a fairly incredible, albeit lights in the sky, object in the sky experience.
Now, is this photo available online to see anywhere?
If you Google Baldwin UFO, I think it does pop up to be visible. I've got some really good pictures of it here in my
files. Tell you what. Well, I'll just interrupt you here for a second. If you just send me the photo for the listener out there, I will put this in the show notes, so it will be there. Now, I have heard...
Happy to share it, Martin.
Certainly. I've heard that other people have said that they've actually witnessed crafts turning up on their side and moving. And there's a Ray Stanford supposedly filmed one with a beam of like energy or something pointing out from the front. So that does seem to be a reoccurring theme.
It certainly is. And also this object that the witness saw in Baldwin was also silent. So you've got all the classic hallmarks of what a UFO actually is. You know, it appears suddenly. It flashes a bright light. It's silent. It disappears at a rapid rate of knots, leaving everybody who sees it very puzzled in its wake.
Right, right. Now, we had a question come in a little while ago on the chat room, and they wanted to know what your view is on disclosure. And I'd also like to ask this, a two-part question. What is the general government's view on UFOs in general?
The Australian government is certainly different to the government in the United States. And Australians are also, for the most part, a fairly relaxed type of country. In that the government certainly has investigated UFOs, very similar to the United States. The Air Force was responsible for it in a very similar time period as in America. They felt like they had to be seen to be doing something so that the public could feel that it was being investigated by the most appropriate department to do so. They certainly investigated many, many, many reports around the country. In fact, they visited Ron at his house and investigated his car. So they certainly were very active over many, many many, many years. Now, of course, very similar to the US government, it was always a kind of a debunking approach to it with, you know, things like birds, satellites, all the usual things that they could come up with. But then they reached a point where they kind of stopped investigating it and really made the decision that it wasn't something that the Air Force wanted to spend its time doing. So that's when the civilian groups, which had also been around at the time, probably came to the fore a bit more. Now, as we all know, with civilian groups, everybody struggles for funding, everybody struggles for members. Having the resources that are required has been a struggle over the years. So at that point in time, it was really left to the civilians to follow through reports, and the police certainly weren't interested either. So the governments had really decided that it wasn't something that they needed to, certainly publicly at least, be seen to be involved in. And I think for the most part, the public could probably accept that too. So, but they did start to release files. They reached the point where they started to make files available through Freedom of Information, and great researchers in Australia like Keith Basterfield has been instrumental in discovering the files, getting access to the files. Bill Chalker was given access to the files, and both those two leading researchers who've done so much for UFO research in Australia certainly got stuck into the files. So the government has been, I suppose, they've seen to be willing to share information. Now, whether everything has been shared, there's a question mark remains with that one. And I certainly wouldn't stand here and say that there's things that they've revealed fully, because we didn't find anything on the Burke's Flat case in the files. We didn't find anything in Westall, as Shane alluded to as well. People came and spoke to the students. They spoke to Ron. You know, investigations and questions were done. But the information, the results of those inquiries, they have not come to light. So the government has been seen to be doing something, probably enough to be seen to be cooperative to a point, but at the end of the day, we don't have the answers to the classic cases. And on disclosure, I think realistically, it's very hard to see certainly the American government coming forth with what they know. Other governments around the world, France, Australia, South American countries, have all been a lot more forthcoming. But I really think disclosure is going to come through an event. Something's going to happen.
You share that opinion with many people I speak to.
It's going to be an event. You know, the elephant in the room will just be there. And people are just going to have to go, yeah, wow, there's the object. Yep, there they are. They're walking around. Here's a fleet of motherships, you know, landing somewhere or making a display that absolutely nobody can dispute. And I think you'll find that when that actually happens, the governments of the world are going to look rather silly, and predominantly the United States government, because the deny policy is really, I think, ultimately going to bite them very much in a big way when an event like this occurs, and also with countries like Russia and other countries, you know, opening up their files. And there's more and more stuff coming out of Pandora's box all the time. The world's ready for it. Everybody's ready for it. We all know it. It just has to be said. And if they're not prepared to do it for whatever reasons, I'm pretty sure that the occupants of these extraordinary crafts will probably ultimately do it for us.
Yeah, it seems almost like it feels like it's heading that direction. But, you know, I heard someone say that, like, back in the 1970s, too.
Well, you know, that's true, Martin. Yeah, I mean, and we could be sitting here another 30 years and you know, all, you know, wondering, having the exact same conversation.
Yeah, right.
You know, I certainly don't have, you know, because we're a very practical organisation, you know, we're looking at evidence. That's what we're here to look at, you know, and the evidence is out there. You know, it's there to be found through the government files, through reinvestigating cold cases. If you're lucky to get new current cases, also there. The evidence is there. The experiences are there. But, you know, but getting that conclusive proof, and we tend to steer clear of the esoteric side of the phenomenon to a certain extent. Certainly myself, mm-hmm. Andrew and Ivan, who are the driving body of UFOA, we tend to stay away from the more esoteric aspects of it, because, and I'm certainly not, you know, saying that it's not valid by any stretch, because I firmly believe that it is. But we've decided to be an organisation that focuses really on investigation. What proof have we actually got? I would say that we are friendly sceptics from the point of view that we are believers. We do believe in UFOs. We believe that they are here. But we really want to back it up with show us the evidence, because that's what the skeptics are going to say. The skeptics are going to say it's lovely that someone's reported that they were taken from their bedroom or all that sort of stuff, but nobody can quantify that in a way that is in a touchy-feely kind of way. And there'll be people out there that have a problem with that attitude, perhaps from the point of view that these events are occurring, and I agree they are. But as a UFO investigation organisation, We really have to focus on evidence.
Right. Now, I want to talk a little bit about cold cases and your investigation of them. But before that, this is the one night I'm having trouble remembering my questions. I should be writing them down. So let's go. Oh, I know exactly what it was. Getting back to when the government lost interest and then the civilian organizations sort of took over, would that be about the same time that Project Blue Book closed down? Do you know?
I think we've pretty much followed the American lead. Mm-hmm. For the most part. I haven't spent a lot of time myself going through the government files and the government records. People like Bill and Keith are far more qualified to offer really, you know, strong comments on that particular aspect of it. You know, we've tended to focus on what we've focused on. But just through my general reading, my general interest in the phenomenon, certainly the Australian government certainly does seem to be mirroring what the United States does in general, and I think that we don't have the drama associated with it that the American government has, and for the most part the population in Australia is probably relatively relaxed about the whole situation.
Right. Now, one of the questions that came to mind before we talk a little bit about the cold cases is how does the abduction scene work in Australia compared to the United States, where it seems like there's so much going on or so many people claiming this is happening? What type of reports do you get in there?
Well, we have virtually the very same reports. The classic stories of grey beings appearing in bedrooms, mantis beings, reptoids. We have the same things reported. The same scenarios. The same effects occurring to people who are reporting these incidences. The same aftermath that occurs with these experiences. America probably has a much better network for helping people due to the larger population, and certainly it's probably been in the American forefront for a lot longer than it has been in Australia. But each state in Australia has got its own reputable UFO organisation, and as an aspect of those organisations, every one of them offers abduction support, hypnotherapy, and counselling. And some groups will do it more involved than other groups. So groups in Queensland and New South Wales, and will certainly have a stronger focus in that area. We also do have the referral system for people who come in. We also go through a process of examining what happened, and if we believe it's worthy of referral, then we will refer it on to people who can help in that area. But the core phenomenon is here. It occurs in the exact same way as it occurs in the United States, and I think that there's not enough support for people out there. There's still a lot of people who are embarrassed, who are shamed, who are frightened, who don't want to be seen as crazy, certainly by their peers and their family members. A lot of people struggle with it, and it manifests itself into other problems in their lives. And that's why we really are sympathetic to it, and we do believe that VUFOA has a role to play in pointing people in the right direction so that they can get the appropriate help that's required. But not a lot of psychologists or hypnotherapists necessarily in general would take it from an alien perspective. And people like Mary Rodwell in Queensland is doing a fantastic leading job in that area and is certainly the country's most well-known specialist in that area. We have Brenda Butler here in Victoria, who's one of our team members. She is also very skilled in this area. And it's really about uncovering the people that are out there having the experiences, building the trust with them so that they know they are in a safe environment, that whatever comes out of their mouths is fine, that we aren't going to be critical of them. And as you dig deeper and we get out into the suburbs and you make inquiries and you take it to the streets, you start to see that many, many people are having these experiences.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'm always sort of a little bit on the fence on that whole subject. I have a hard time with that, you know. And of course, if it something like that happened to me, you know, I'm certain that I would change my mind. But you know, I do believe there are some real credible cases. But I often wonder if there's other things that people may be experiencing. So I would say I have a little bit of skepticism about a lot of the abduction experiences that are claimed. But I, you know, I don't know. I'm not saying that I know.
Well,
Martin,
I have spoken to some people who are really wrecked by these experiences. You know, it's not like a dream or, you know, a waking situation like that or a nightmare. You know, these people just display the signs of you know, much stronger emotion and stronger reactions to something that has occurred to them in some capacity. What that is certainly requires a lot more work. It certainly probably I reckon it requires government interest in it to really get to the core of what's happening with these types of experiences. The phenomenon itself, I believe, there's really one of two ways. I mean, they're either coming from outer space, you know, and manipulating time and space, or they're coming dimensionally. So whatever way they get here, and there's thousands of theories on the, you know, the wherefores and why hows, they are way more advanced than us. They really can come in and out of our reality at whim, and I believe that they certainly can do whatever they like to humans and other animals. And that's why I think, you know, there's been plenty of cases where UFOs have appeared with, you know, just like, well, here we are, you know, and people have been around and then they take off. So, you know, there certainly is a lot of, a lot to it.
Now, I was going to talk to you more about the cold cases, but we only have about, maybe 2 or 3 minutes left here right now.
Yep.
So, but I want to ask you this, you know, in the U.S., there's a lot of these strange things that go on where in an area, so to speak, there'll be a UFO sighting, and then next thing you know, people are seeing ghosts, and then people are seeing Bigfoot. This whole weird thing is happening. I hear it over and over again, and a lot of people are kind of saying the same thing. I don't know what to think about that. I'm just wondering, is there anyone reporting anything like that in Australia?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, we certainly have our fair share of, you know, they're called Yowies over here rather than Sasquatch or Bigfoot. We have, you know, there certainly would be cases probably on record that I don't have any to hand where it almost seems to be like, you know, reality kind of alters in some way. Like, you know, people report, you know, like things going quiet and you know, the, like time standing still and things like that. And that can be associated with Bigfoot reports, can be associated with ghost reports, can be associated with UFO reports. So if time and space can operate in ways that we don't yet understand, then I think that most certainly some aspects of this phenomenon could certainly be related. Do I have evidence to prove it? No, I don't. But am I open to the idea? I certainly am open to the idea that, that you know, the universe is much, much stranger than I think we give credit for in our day-to-day lives. It's an amazing place, and it's very dynamic. And when you get beyond Earth and you can see what's going on out there in the universe, it's an incredible place. And I think it's very easy for us to be like ants on the side of the road and get caught up in our little lives and become very limited in our vision. And, you know, I do think that, yes, most certainly these aspects could certainly be potentially related.
Right. That's really interesting. And I want to say I really appreciated you, hopping up to the plate here at the last minute and filling in for our very sick guest.
No problems at all, Martin. Happy to talk, and I'm very passionate about the topic.
And
yeah.
Also, one more time, the website and your email address so people can reach out to you.
Yeah, look, if you're really keen to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you here in Australia. Our website is www.vufoa.com. isaacfly.com. Very straightforward. If anyone wants to talk to me about what we've discussed today or any other aspects, more than happy to talk to anybody out there. Welcome all inquiries. My email address is Ben, B-E-N-H, at V-U-F-O-A.com.
Very good. And when can we expect one of your films to come out?
I think we're getting to the last stages of post-production. I've got another lead that I'm chasing up at the moment that I need to come to fruition. And I think you'll see it come out onto our website to start off with in February, perhaps early March. We didn't get to talk about Gary Taylor at all, which was a bit of a shame because I have got a lot of information on him and the accident, so perhaps another time. It certainly shouldn't be too far away. And look, it's going to be a cracker. It really is. It's really brought this case, back to the fore and into people's minds in ufology in Australia. And I really do encourage, people in America to get into it. It's an incredible story.
Very good. Well, thanks so much. Again, it was great talking to you tonight.
No problems, Martin. My pleasure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out links to the stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. I want to thank everyone that helped out today, including Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Keith Rowland, the producer of Dark Matter Radio Network, as well as Peggy Shunning for adminning our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO and astronomy news. You can check us out live next week right here and every week after at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 1 a.m. UTC, right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Remember, keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high. This is Martin Willis, and bye for now.